My guest at this time is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. He's also the author of a column titled Against the Balanced Budget Amendment. At a time when most conservatives up on Capitol Hill are strongly pushing the idea of a balanced budget amendment as the linchpin to any meaningful debt reform, Rich says a closer look at this as well as constitutional history suggests this might not be the best idea. And Rich, it's always good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You call this, in pretty strong language, possibly the worst disservice to the Constitution since Prohibition. And basically your argument is that the Constitution kind of lays out general parameters for how the government should function, and when the government tries to get too specific, trouble's around the corner, right?
Yes, especially when you're mandating something that there's not the political will to make happen. And if Congress is actually willing to balance the budget, well, then a balanced budget amendment is irrelevant. If Congress is not willing to balance the budget, even if somehow you passed a balanced budget amendment, if we know anything about Congress, it will find, you know, sneaky and tricky ways to get around the injunction to balance the budget, which would lead to lawsuits and all sorts of messiness. So my preference here is quite straightforward. If you think the government's too big and the deficit's too big, cut spending. You don't need to amend the Constitution.
The concern, of course, is that you can cut the spending, but it's non-binding on future Congresses. So should the majorities fluctuate 2, 4, or however many years down the road, then everything you set in motion could quickly be reversed. Is there a better way to move forward that wouldn't be the case?
Well, I think ultimately, if you're going to do anything, it depends on public persuasion and, you know, creating a sustainable, you know, long-term consensus over fiscal policy. And again, if you can do that, you don't need a balanced budget amendment. If you can't do that, it's the end of the day, it's very unlikely you're going to get a balanced budget amendment in the first place. And that's certainly the state of things today, where the balanced budget amendment in the form that Republicans want it, which is quite maximalist from their perspective, it mandates spending at 18% of GDP, that's about 6% less in terms of GDP than where we are now, it says you can only raise taxes with a two-thirds vote. There's no way you're going to get Democrats to support that, and you need two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate. So this is going exactly nowhere, even if it were a good idea.
If it were a good idea. And you talk about some of the provisions in here. You already mentioned some of them, the specific capping of spending at 18% of GDP, the two-thirds majority needed to change taxes, certainly to raise taxes. You also talk about another provision in here that would allow an exception in the case of a declaration of war, which you say sounds good, but given recent American history in the past several decades, we don't actually do those anymore. So we could be in a little bit of a pickle if you think about what happened during the many decades of the Cold War and where we are now entering decade two of the War on Terror.
Yeah, there are two provisions related to that. One says if you have a declaration of war against a nation state, then you can waive the balanced budget amendment for those expenditures. But, you know, we don't do declarations of war anymore. The other says if we're in some military conflict that involves our national security, you can waive the balanced budget amendment for expenditures related to that. And that's where arguably the Cold War, arguably the War on Terror would have applied. And these have been decades-long events. So you could have had a balanced budget amendment on the books at the same time you wouldn't have actually had a balanced budget, which, again, I think is silly and makes the Constitution liable to be held in contempt, which is really not what you want to happen. And then there are just times, I think, on the merits, you don't necessarily want a balanced budget. A war is one. A recession is another. Let's say if you're a conservative purist and the budget's actually balanced, then you go into recession and you actually do want to stimulate the economy, but you want to do through a tax cut that means you're going to run a deficit for a while. There really is that can be a perfectly sound policy that would be forbidden by the Constitution of the United States. So I really think it's wrong to leverage the Constitution in such relatively picayune matters. Now, I don't mean to minimize the fiscal crisis we're facing, but it really needs to be dealt with over the next couple years. And to get, again, if you had the votes in Congress for a balanced budget amendment, sending it to the states, and then it was going to take years, and then there's a provision in it that says it doesn't take effect for 5 years after that. So we're talking years and years and years from now, even if you could get it through the next week or two. And we're either going to begin to solve our problem before then, or we're going to be in big trouble.
Rich, what do you suspect is the Republican plan here, assuming that we're right and that this, regardless of what you think of the merits of the balanced budget amendment, it's never going to pass, probably the House, much less the Senate. So since a lot of people are hanging the merits of the cuts and the capping on the balanced budget amendment itself, where do you expect Republicans to go, assuming that this budget amendment doesn't go very far?
I still think you'll end up with some very modest package of cuts, you know, modest in the terms of, you know, the big deal that's been talked about. You know, but you could get $1 trillion, you could get $2 trillion, which is better than nothing, and they're going to find some way to patch it over with those cuts until after the election. Although, you know, there's some chance, given how dug in several dozen Republicans are in the House, that nothing passes before August 2nd, and we'll end up with, you know, really high-stakes poker right at the end.
A lot of people holding their nose and suggesting the McConnell plan is not what they want, but probably what we're going to get. Is that a relatively accurate prediction?
I think it may be so poisonous in the House, it's just really hard to get through. You may get, as I say, some small or temporary measure through the House, but I doubt it could be called the McConnell plan or act anything like the McConnell plan, because the McConnell plan is so complex, it just reeks of beltway gamesmanship and responsibility shifting. And I think it may drive Tea Party voters crazier than just a flat-out surrender, because it's kind of a weaselly and complex surrender.
Very interesting. So many different aspects to look at here, but certainly a different take on what a lot of conservatives right now consider the absolute baseline for moving forward on this. We'll see what happens based on the votes in the House and Senate. Rich, always great to have you with us. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Rich Lowry is editor of the National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus for Radio America.